Imagine waking up in the pitch black, heading out the door, and, working a grueling 18-hour shift.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you do this day in and day out for years. You come home exhausted, fall into bed, and just try to get a few hours of sleep before doing it all over again.
Right.
Now, imagine realizing that the company demanding those 18 hours of your life, well, they also own the bed you are sleeping in.
Yeah, that's a heavy realization.
They own the roof over your head.
Yeah.
And you, no matter how many hours you give them, will never actually be allowed to buy that house. You're entirely dependent on the very system that's just, exhausting you.
Exactly. And that specific kind of systemic trap, that was the reality for a massive segment of the working class in mid to late 20th century Colombia.
Right.
We often look at history through the lens of these like sweeping political movements or grand economic theories. But I mean, the most profound historical records are sometimes much smaller. They're much more intimate, and they might just be hanging on a living room wall.
Which brings us to our focus today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are exploring excerpts and visual analysis from this really remarkable book project called Trastio, which was created by Art Color Agua.
It's a fantastic project.
It really is.
Yeah.
But we aren't doing a broad overview of the entire book today. We are going to zoom in on one specific piece of evidence. It's this poignant graphite portrait of a man named Edgar Duque, and it was actually drawn by his own son, the artist Jairo Duque.
So our mission here, for everyone listening, is to use this single portrait of a father as a lens to decode an entire generation of urban labor.
Right.
We're going to look at the mechanisms of corporate dependency, the changing nature of work, and just the complex realities of Latin American society over the last several decades. And it's all etched into a single piece of paper.
And before we get into the biography of the man in the drawing, we really have to talk about the physical drawing itself because it sets the tone for everything else.
Oh, absolutely.
The sources describe this incredibly striking image. It's graphite and pencil. Edgar's face takes up almost the entire frame, tilted slightly.
Yeah, very close up.
And there is zero background, like no scenery, no household objects to give you a sense of place.
Nothing to distract you.
Exactly. All of the shading forces your eye directly toward his deeply lined face. But the detail that really made me pause is how uneven the technique is.
Right. The contrast in the lines.
Yeah. Some lines around the eyes are razor sharp and precise, while the edges of the portrait are completely loose. I'll be honest, my first reaction reading the description was that it sounded like a rough
It
draft.
really does sound like that at first.
Okay, let's unpack this. It sounds like a map where the cartographer just, gave up halfway.
Right.
Why would an artist purposefully leave a portrait of their own father looking unfinished instead of giving it a polished photographic quality?
What's fascinating here is that it challenges our whole assumption of what a tribute is supposed to be.
How so?
Well, when we see a highly polished, photorealistic oil painting, the medium is essentially telling the viewer that the subject's legacy is finalized. Like they are a monument.
Right, they're frozen in time perfectly.
Exactly. But Jairo Duque is approaching this from the viewpoint of a painter documenting raw urban life. He isn't interested in monuments.
He wants the reality.
Yeah. By leaving the portrait in this open, unresolved condition, he is visually communicating that this is a memory. And I mean, memory doesn't have perfectly defined edges.
That's a great point. It's sharp in the center and sort of sketchy on the periphery.
Right. So the subject is still in the process of appearing on the paper.
So the artist is deliberately avoiding a romanticized, perfect image. He wants the viewer to see the wear and tear.
He really does. He is utilizing those deep wrinkles and heavy shadows, not as flaws to be airbrushed out, but as the literal physical map of Edgar's biography.
Like the lines of his life.
Exactly. The goal of this kind of social documentation is to present the unidealized truth. It's not a glossy history. The portrait is a meeting place on paper between the father who lived an unimaginably hard life and the son who, years later, is observing him and trying to understand the forces that shaped him.
And those wrinkles certainly didn't come from a life of leisure.
No, definitely not.
The sources detail Edgar's work history, and if you saw it on a resume today, you might think the person was just wildly unfocused.
Oh, completely scattered.
Right. He transported milk in a clunky Jeep Willys in the town of Tuluá.
A classic.
Then he worked in a vineyard near the Farfán airport. Then he bounced to a government vehicle garage.
Just all over the place.
It keeps going. He managed a soda fountain in Buga, then worked at the La Cabaña sugar mill. And he even drove a potato truck from PNMO.
Wow.
He was constantly pivoting, just jumping from one completely unrelated thing to another.
Which, you know, is the defining characteristic of El Rebusque.
Que se rebusque.
That's a fundamental Colombian term, and we really need to understand the mechanism behind it. El Rebusque translates loosely to hustling or finding odd jobs.
But it's not like a modern side hustle.
No, no. It isn't a fun gig economy thing. It is a structural necessity in an economy that fails to provide a stable, formal safety net.
You just have to survive.
Exactly. When the formal economy shuts you out, you have to improvise daily to keep your family fed. You become a master of adaptation because, well, the alternative is starvation.
But he did eventually find a formal position.
He did.
The text highlights his time working at the newspaper El País in the city of Cali. And on paper, working for a major newspaper sounds like the moment he finally achieved stability and left El Rebusque behind.
Right. Sounds like the dream. But it's crucial to look closely at the specific details the sources provide about this period at El País.
Make sure we clarify this.
Yeah, because that so-called stability was incredibly dark. This wasn't a standard 40-hour work week. Not at all. Edgar worked extended, grueling shifts that frequently reached 18 hours a day.
18 hours. I mean, you have to factor in commuting, eating, and just basic hygiene.
Right.
That leaves perhaps 3 or 4 hours for sleep. You are essentially a ghost in your own home at that point.
You really are. And this brings us to the core mechanism of systemic exploitation we mentioned earlier in the intro.
The housing situation.
Yes. While Edgard was giving 18 hours of his day to the newspaper, his family was living in a house provided by the company.
Oh, okay.
And the text is very clear on a critical clarification here.
Yeah.
We really need to emphasize this. Edgard never bought that house.
He never owned it.
Never. It was merely a rental assigned by the company to his employees.
So his employer is simultaneously his landlord.
Exactly.
I can see how that completely paralyzes a worker. If your boss is just your boss, you can theoretically strike or demand better hours or, you know, quit and look for a new job.
Right, you have options.
But if your boss is your landlord, quitting means your wife and children are instantly on the street.
Exactly. It was a highly calculated mechanism of corporate control. By tying housing to employment, the company guaranteed a captive workforce at an exceptionally low cost.
It's a trap.
A total trap. They engineered a deep structural dependency. The workers terrified of losing their job, so they accept the 18-hour shifts without complaint.
Right.
It is paternalistic capitalism at its most effective. I mean, framing a shackle as a generous company benefit.
Which highlights this massive contradiction explored in the Trastio book.
Yeah.
On one hand, work is how Edgard maintained his dignity. It's how he fed his 6 children. He was providing.
He was doing what he had to do.
Right. But on the other hand, the very act of providing was a space of severe exploitation where immense life-draining effort never translated into actual economic freedom or fair compensation.
The effort and the reward were entirely decoupled.
Completely separated.
Yeah. The economic system was designed to ensure that no matter how hard Edgard paddled, he would never actually reach the shore of financial independence.
That structural pressure, I mean, working 18 hours a day, sleeping in a bed owned by the company, constantly fearing ruin, that doesn't just evaporate when you walk through your front door.
No, you carry that with you.
It bleeds into the living room. And the sources are incredibly frank about Edgard's home life. They don't paint him as a flawless martyr.
And to understand the man in the home, we have to look at the social context he came from.
The neighborhood.
Right. The text notes that Edgard's family settled in the Barrio Puyana, in the municipality of Sevilla.
And I want to make sure we clarify something really important from the sources here, especially for anyone listening who knows Colombian history.
Oh, yeah, the surname.
Exactly. They lived in a neighborhood called Puyana, but they were absolutely not related to the famously wealthy and prestigious family with the Puyana surname.
Right. That distinction tells us a lot about his social reality. He was adjacent to the name of prestige, physically living in that barrio. But he belonged firmly to the working class.
Very firmly.
Despite this, his grandfather apparently still harbored deep social expectations and, well, prejudices about who Edgard was supposed to marry.
And this is where we see Edgard's first real act of agency.
His quiet rebellion.
Yeah. He rebelled against his family's expectations. He fell in love with a beautiful, poor woman, chose to marry her, and fiercely defended that decision against his family's opposition.
Which is huge.
In a life where his employer dictated his hours and owned his home, choosing his own wife was a profound act of claiming ownership over his own destiny.
It was an intimate rebellion. But you know, the stresses of his life still took a toll on him.
They really did. The text explicitly mentions his flaws. Edgar drank liquor.
Yeah.
He smoked cigarettes constantly, and he could be highly verbally intolerant inside the house. He was, in many ways, reproducing the classic machismo of his era.
Which is a tough reality to confront.
It is. Now, you might be thinking, why are we spending a whole deep dive analyzing a man who was, frankly, a difficult and sometimes toxic presence at home?
Right. It's a fair question.
Usually, when a child writes a tribute or draws a portrait of a parent, they sanitize the history. They scrub out the drinking and the yelling. Why would the artist leave those dark spots in the narrative?
Because scrubbing out the flaws would erase the reality of what the economic system did to people.
Oh, that's a powerful way to look at it.
It really is.
Yeah.
The son's approach as an artist is deeply mature. He isn't justifying the verbal intolerance or the drinking.
No.
He is contextualizing it. He is asking the viewer to consider what happens to the human psyche when you combine deeply rooted cultural machismo with the crushing precariousness of 18-hour workdays and the constant threat of poverty.
It's acknowledging that trauma and exhaustion manifest in ugly ways.
Exactly. The portrait holds all these contradictions at once.
Yeah.
It recognizes the harm caused within the walls of the house while simultaneously acknowledging that this man, carrying all his demons and physical exhaustion, well, he never abandoned his family.
Right, he stayed.
He kept six children alive under incredibly unfavorable circumstances.
Yeah.
Furthermore, he was a man capable of quiet beauty.
The sources mention some really nice details.
Yeah, he loved to read. He did crosswords. He had meticulous handwriting. And he was known in his neighborhood for his spontaneous sociability. Like, he would just stand on a street corner and strike up vibrant conversations with total strangers.
He was a whole person.
Exactly.
And this brings up a crucial point about analyzing history. Understanding the forces that shaped someone is not the same as absolving them of their actions. You don't have to turn Edgar into a saint to recognize the profound dignity in his struggle.
And if you turn him into a saint, you lose the actual man.
You do.
You lose the poorly paid worker and the flawed husband, which means you lose the truth of the era.
That nuance is really put to the test in a story the sources share about a protest in Cali.
Oh, this is a great story.
It really is. As the son, Jairo, grew up, he became involved in social protests. At one point, he was detained by authorities for painting protest graffiti on the Confondi building. Now, if I put myself in that situation, if my father was an exhausted, traditional man from a strict machismo culture, and I got arrested for painting political graffiti, I would fully expect him to let me rot in detention to teach me a lesson, or worse, completely disown me.
Right. The expectation is absolute authoritarian discipline.
Yeah.
But Edgar's reaction subverts that entirely. He intervened. He went and helped get his son out of detention.
He didn't demand absolute relationship-breaking obedience.
No, he didn't.
Maybe he recognized a bit of his own youthful rebellion. You know, the guy who defied his family to marry a poor woman. Maybe he saw that in his son's political graffiti.
That's a really poignant parallel. And that moment marks a significant shift in their dynamic.
How so?
Well, Edgar allowed his son the space to have his own rebellions. Mm-hmm. He didn't crush it. And as they both aged, that dynamic just continued to evolve.
They actually ended up working together, didn't they?
They did.
The sources describe them doing residential repair work in Cali later in life, but the hierarchy had completely flipped. The father became the assistant to the son. Wow.
And they didn't just work in silence. They spent those hours deep in conversation, debating politics and economics.
So the authoritarian dictator of the house slowly transformed into an equal.
Yes. The text mentions that in his later years, Edgar would actually tell people that his son was his best friend.
Oh, wow.
Which completely recontextualizes the portrait for me. Mm-hmm. When you look at that graphite drawing, you aren't just looking at a son trying to capture a strict father.
No.
You are looking at a man meticulously trying to immortalize his lost best friend.
That is beautiful. And we can connect that directly back to the physical medium of the drawing itself.
The graphite.
Right. Graphite lacks simplistic bright colors. It doesn't allow for an artificially cheerful or like flatly heroic depiction.
It's all just shades of gray.
Exactly. It is defined entirely by its grayscale.
Yeah.
By the contrast between the dark, heavy pencil strokes and the blank, illuminated spaces of the paper.
It physically represents a relationship that has areas of deep shadow and unresolved tension sitting right alongside areas of light and profound friendship. The drawing, much like the Trastio book itself, insists that a life is never just one thing.
As we step back and look at the broader themes we've pulled from these sources today, Edgar Duke really emerges as a representation of a working-class trinity.
Resistance, work, and rebellion.
Exactly. He exhibited resistance just to survive the daily precariousness of his environment. He used work, even when it was highly exploitative, as a mechanism to preserve his family's dignity.
Right.
And he showed rebellion, first in his marriage, and later in his willingness to evolve from a traditional authority figure into a friend.
Proving that the difficult conditions you inherit don't have to permanently dictate who you become.
Yes.
And this is why engaging with documentary art and projects like Draftio is so vital.
It really changes your perspective.
It demonstrates that history doesn't need to be polished or, you know, cast in marble to be important. True historical analysis requires looking at the messy, unfinished sketches of everyday survival.
So as we wrap up today, I want to leave you with a thought to mull over. Think about the oldest photograph or portrait you have of a relative in your own family.
Oh, that's a good exercise.
If you were to draw their life today, not as a sanitized tribute, but using only the raw lines of their specific struggles, the economic realities they navigated, the systems they were dependent on, and the personal contradictions they carried, what hidden stories of quiet rebellion or unexpected friendship might suddenly appear on the page?
Really makes you wonder.
It completely changes how you view your own history. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.